Welcome to It's Who You Know, the podcast, bridging the gap between Jewish leaders and those who follow them. Gain insight from Jewish professionals who make the decisions that influence your Jewish world.
Welcome to It's Who You Know, the podcast. This is your host, Michelle W. Malkin. My guest today is Lisa Colton, who is the founder and president of Darim Online and Darim Consulting, and was previously the chief learning officer at C3 Communications. She helps nonprofits align themselves for success in today's digital connected age through strategic planning and communications consulting. While her clients range from international organizations to local nonprofits in a variety of fields, she has a particular focus in the Jewish community, including recent work with Women of Reform Judaism, Samus Foundation, and UJA Federation of New York. Much of Lisa's energy focuses on helping people and organizations innovate and helping innovators mature and strengthen their work. She's on the board of Seattle Country Day School, Bim Bam, which was previously Godcast, and the Lakeside School Alumni Board. She's also a partner of the Kavana Cooperative, a member of Temple Beth Am, and a volunteer with Lemud Seattle. I had the pleasure of working with Lisa on a strategic plan for the organization I work with and was intrigued by the many findings and recommendations from her team. So intrigued, in fact, that I wanted to hear more from her regarding her experience creating Darim Online and working with organizations at critical junctions in their organizational life. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Wonderful. So we'll start, as we always do, just a little bit about your very full career journey, as we've just heard, and what brought you into the work you're doing now.
Well, I often say it was a very unplanned and slightly selfish start. I went to Jerusalem to study and volunteer and live for about a year and a half after college and came back to the States after having grown up in Seattle, gone to school in the Silicon Valley in the 90s as the internet was exploding, spending time in Israel, which was also a pretty technological savvy society. And I came back as a 20-something to the American Jewish community and started looking for ways to get involved. For me, that meant looking online. What I found was pretty bleak and atrocious. Black websites with hot pink animated GIFs that had been designed by a cantor's 14-year-old son extra credit or something. What I realized pretty quickly was not that the American Jewish community was represented by hot pink animated GIFs, but rather that the leaders of these organizations who were doing incredible things didn't yet know how to take advantage of the digital tools that were emerging and also didn't know really how to speak to my generation, right? I was post-Hillel and pre-synagogue membership, and we were all falling through the cracks. Because of that, I started talking to a number of rabbis or executive directors or people who are running interesting programs and sharing my observations. And I heard the same thing over and over again. Like, we know there's an opportunity here and we know we should be doing something different, but we really just don't know where to begin. And so I gathered all those people together. It was really refreshing for them all to hear that they had the same questions. And I was just an example of one, but I felt like I represented a generation and an opportunity that was much bigger. And together we wrote a grant, and then we were off and running to try to creatively solve this problem.
Who was the first funder?
First funder was STAR, Synagogues Transformation and Renewal, and it was for a cohort of synagogues. And most of that money was coming from the Schusterman Family Foundation at that time. And then my relationship with Schusterman continued for years after.
And so that was the creation of Darim?
That was. I had been applying for a number of other positions, including program directors at Hillel's and whatnot. And STAR said, we want to support this project. So I pulled back from all those other offers and dove in. So I was never planning on being an entrepreneur. And I was honestly never planning on working in the Jewish community. But both of those things were always things that I gravitated towards. So in the end, it wasn't much of a surprise. And being able to combine my business skills with an interest in technology and Jewish learning was actually a very natural fit.
And how long has the organization been around now?
Over 18 years, amazingly.
So walk us through a little bit of what those 18 years have been like, how it, you know, the initial thought with that initial cohort and where you are today.
Yeah, well, I like to say that my job kind of changes every 18 to 24 months, which is why I'm still doing it almost 20 years later. Partially that's because the technology changes, partially because it's the needs of the organizations change. Society is changing. So what's needed is always really different. I like to work with organizations that are on the front of the bell curve, meaning they're willing to take some risks, they're willing to innovate, they're willing to try new things, they're also willing to fail, and they're just kind of game for it with less fear and risk involved. And that those pioneers really change the bell curve. If you can pull the front edge of the bell curve forward, the whole bell curve shifts. And to me, that's like the most fun place to work, especially when you're talking about innovation or technology and just pioneering new things. But those can be really tiny organizations, or they can be, you know, international size organizations. They can be legacy ones like a synagogue that's been around for 100 years, or it could be a total startup. So I enjoy working with all of those. The history of Darim really started out as building websites and the very first content management systems and some syndicated content for those synagogues. I did that website work for a long time, and then it kind of morphed into email communications, and then it morphed into social media, and then it morphed into more kind of professional development and thinking about communication strategy and kind of even executive coaching writ large. And then more recently, that has really bled into strategic planning, because communications doesn't just exist in a vacuum, and it's not actually about the technology. It's about using it all as a tool to accomplish your mission and pursue your goals. So as I realized that people were having a hard time seeing the connection between the strategy and the technology and the tactics, it begged a lot of other kinds of questions, right? If you're running your organization in a very top-down way, but you're trying to be successful with social media, which is a very bottom-up and social space, you can see the natural conflict. So for many older, more traditional legacy organizations that have grown up in and have a culture that was fueled by a baby boomer generation, it's not surprising that that culture and strategy may not be so resonant with a millennial audience. And if that organization wants to be successful with millennials and weather these changing times successfully, it's going to mean more than being on Instagram. And so we look at some of those deeper strategic questions. And for me, that's really fun.
It's really not that easy. Just an Instagram account fixes it all.
No. Sorry.
So it's very interesting that you found yourself in this space that not only was innovative at the time in which you kind of started in seeing this problem and creating a solution to it, but something that's very much changing very rapidly. So it's wonderful that you're looking for those organizations that are ready. And you mentioned a little bit about, you know, it's hard to make that shift. What are some of the things that you're kind of finding as trends with the organizations that you're working with? Is it the same recommendations that you're making, or is it new with every organization? Are there any kind of things that are just like, gosh, if everyone just knew to do X, Y, or Z, or to start thinking in this different way, I'd be out of a business. But are there trends, or is everyone unique as to how they're approaching these problems?
It's a great question. I think every organization is a little bit unique in what they do and where they're positioned and what their challenges are, for sure. But there are some themes that I would say come up a lot across all organizations of various types and sizes. One is to really think in a systems kind of way, that having an aha moment or making one policy change or getting one new piece of technology is not actually going to achieve the bigger picture shift and evolution that basically every organization needs. It's really an all hands on deck kind of task to make sure that everybody sees the world in the same way, understands what the priorities and goals are, what are the markers of success, and we're all kind of rowing in the same direction and supporting each other. One example of that is a project I did in New York with UJ Federation of New York and a pilot group of six congregations. It was called Connected Congregations, and the idea was to help synagogues be more social and more communal. Having that strong community was necessary to have a strong congregation, which is necessary to have a strong synagogue as an institution. And so really seeing the need to invest in the people and the relationships in the community in order to achieve the ultimate goal of a strong and sustainable organization. And that's everybody's business, all the staff and all the members of the community, to create a culture that really walks that walk. So systems and kind of seeing how everybody plays a role is one piece of the puzzle. The other, I would say, is really based on empathy. And I think there's two elements that drive this challenge. One is that the people who are running and leading Jewish organizations are, let's just say, for the lack of a better term, insiders, right? They're people who care about this, are very involved, are embedded in the institution. They're sitting at a very different place than the people that they're designing for or hopefully designing with. So that's two challenges. One, they aren't necessarily the target audience. And so being aware of that and really honest about it and being a really good listener and exercising your empathy skills to understand what is it about the people who we want to be participating in our programs or experiences or mission or as donors or whatever else, what's important to them? What's reality in their life? If we're having Hebrew school at 6:30 on a weekday afternoon and they got to get across, you know, traffic during rush hour, like, okay, maybe by design, that isn't ideal. But you can only really understand that and so many other criteria if you can step into the other person's shoes with a lot of honesty and empathy. And the other piece of the puzzle is that we often design for ourselves as leaders and employees of an organization and what might make the most sense or be most logical within an organization, timelines, departmental divisions, those kinds of things, maybe aren't what's a natural organization of those things for the people that we're trying to engage with. So let's say four different departments in one organization send an email on the same day. Well, you're competing for each individual person's attention and they're going to be confused when they get four emails from the same organization because those things weren't coordinated. Really just kind of flipping the perspective is incredibly important to be able to successfully design what you're doing, but more importantly, compete for people's attention and build trust with them over time.
Well, it's very interesting that you mentioned kind of re-putting in the communal of communal, you know, as I mentioned in your bio, you know, Jewish Communal Professionals Association is now JPRO. And I went to a master's degree program that was a master's in Jewish Communal Professionals, something like that. That's now nonprofit management. And so it feels like, you know, that word itself has gone out of style and we've kind of moved away from that as a profession. But is that as a thing that we do, have we lost that? And now it's about trying to refine that and reconnect with that as like a thing that we want to be doing and that we want to be and stop being so, I mean, you talked about just with these synagogues, stop being so bifurcated that it really is a community and not this organization out for this thing and that organization out for that thing. That feels like, do you think we used to have more of that? We moved away from it. Now we're trying to get back to it. Or has it always kind of just been in our name and we've still operated the same?
I'm so glad you asked this question, Michelle. It's really one of my pet peeves that in the Jewish community, we use the word community to refer from everything from who's at my Shabbat dinner table and my closest friends to every Jew who's ever lived throughout time and space all over the world. So we have no nuance to this. And so it becomes this grossly overused catch-all word that's frankly really hollow. And it's an easy word to use from a staff or lay leader perspective because it kind of describes everything you want it to describe. But ultimately, the word community to me is actually a pretty emotional and psychological rich term. It's about people and the bonds and ties between those people. It does not mean that 500 people are sitting in the same room at the same time. It's about what those people do for each other outside of that room all the other days of the week. And I think we have gotten very lazy, partially because what we're measuring in the Jewish community are the things that are generally easy to measure, who's lighting Shabbos candles or having a Passover Seder or raising their children Jewish. And tushes and seats. Tushes and seats are easy to measure, but it doesn't say anything at all really about community. How many people do I know? Who's watching out for me? Who notices when I don't show up? Mm-hmm. Who's taking care of my kids while I'm having my gallbladder removed? Whatever those things are. And I would say our organizations have largely, I think, this is a gross generalization, but fallen out of the business of building and encouraging and supporting that kind of community because we have focused so much on organizations and institutions and balancing our budgets and having good data to write grants and whatever. And this is the softer stuff. Now, I'll back up a little ways and say in my grandparents' generation, it wasn't just tushes and seats on Saturday morning because all of those kids went to school together. The parents bumped into each other at the grocery store and at the bus stop, and they were all part of the same other kind of civic organization. So there was many, many more ties within the community that was the foundation on which the synagogues or the schools or the camps kind of built their programming. The problem we have now is that that's not, at least in the non-Orthodox Jewish community, it's not a given. Right. And nobody's filling in that gap. And so I believe we need to become more skilled at doing that and much more intentional in doing it. And the places I see that are doing a great job of it are actually finding tremendous success, because if those are your friends and your confidants and your children's friends and the people who watch out for you and you watch out for them, those ties just become stronger and stronger and stronger, infused with Jewish values and infused with Jewish observance and activities too.
Right. And the value of that is far beyond the money. And I think that's really hard for nonprofits to really, you know, get their mind around, that if you have a congregant who, you know, say you don't have a lot of 20s and 30s in your community, but another community that's close by does, and you have members that you connect with them, and maybe sometimes they go to your synagogue, maybe sometimes they have programming at a different synagogue, and it's not about where their membership dollars are going, right? It's about that they're engaged and connected with one another. And that's really hard to do when you're looking at a budget and you're looking at your membership and you're trying to run a business, essentially, to keep that like communal importance at the forefront of the work that you're doing.
Yeah. And we see all sorts of industries, either because of certain pressures or because of innovation, the business model is just totally overturned. So I think Uber and Lyft are a good example of that in terms of transportation, and Airbnb is a great example of that in kind of, you know, the hotel world. But what we see in those examples is not just innovation as kind of competition. It also fundamentally changes the marketplace. Mm-hmm. So there are way more people who use Uber and Lyft today than whoever would call a taxi to take that same kind of trip, right? There are people who are giving up having a car because owning it and the maintenance and the licensing and the insurance and whatever is way more expensive than just using Uber or Lyft every time I need to ride somewhere. So we actually see that the marketplace and the economy for those services has grown tremendously because of that innovation. So in our world as Jewish communal professionals and leaders looking to engage more people and engage those people more deeply, I think we have a lot to learn by not just kind of tinkering around the edges, but maybe wiping the slate clean and thinking about how might we redesign this, not just the product, but kind of the economy and the marketplace of it all. And what would happen if it looked entirely different, if it wasn't so institutional, if it wasn't so transactional? And I suspect that we will see in the next, I would say, 20 years, some pretty significant change in this regard. New things coming up that are going to be quite successful, and also a lot of more traditional models that will be increasingly threatened, and maybe, you know, fewer number of them around.
You've been listening to It's Who You Know, the podcast. This is your host, Michelle W. Malkin. Before turning to my conversation with Lisa, I'd like to take a moment to introduce you to the guest for our next podcast episode. Josh Miller is the Chief Program Officer for the Jim Joseph Foundation, who discusses with me the funding philosophy behind the foundation and how the foundation's work and the needs of the community have changed over the years. Here is a clip from our upcoming conversation.
I've been in this role for 10 years. That's a first for me, and certainly maybe less common than it used to be in the working world in general. I've been really lucky that this role has been able to grow and evolve with me. You know, I said I started out as a program officer, which is kind of an entry-level role here at the foundation. And over time, as I was able to learn about grant making, which I'd never known about from this mm-hmm. side of the work, I've been able to take on different kinds of responsibilities. And now where I sit as chief program officer, thinking really about the strategy of the foundation overall and thinking about how do I support and manage my team and how do I go out into the world and represent the work that we're doing and how do I keep learning about what's changing. And as long as I feel like I continue to add value in this context, I'm going to stay right where I am and enjoy the balance and the rich learning and the feeling that I'm, you know, making the difference that I want to make.
Be sure to listen to the rest of my conversation with Josh in our next episode of It's Who You Know. But for now, back to Lisa. And that brings me, you know, kind of to my next topic, how much engagement or just kind of thinking about the future as you so wonderfully just mentioned, and how much this engagement is kind of moving online. And I'm in a place in which I'm thinking about my own ways that I want to engage. And as I mentioned on this program, I have an hour and a half commute each way from work and home. And I was very involved in the Jewish community, professional community, in my synagogue, and all these different places in Los Angeles where I lived. And moving here and having such limited time during the week to be involved in anything else, I am all about online. We're sitting here on a Zoom call. I have committee calls that are done by Zoom. And to me, and I'll mention it here first, one of my next projects will be bringing development professionals together in an online capacity to learn and grow from each other, because I just can't get out of my house and go drive 20, 30 minutes to a limited amount of people that I have access to have those same kind of conversations that you can have so incredibly seamlessly online together from people from all over the country in a way that we weren't able to have before. So I'm just curious, when you think about those things that we're thinking about in the future as, you know, new and exciting, how much of this engagement is going to take place online in people's homes or kind of on their own schedule? And is that good? Is that good? Or is it, you know, the fact that we're losing the in-person sitting down in a circle of chairs talking about some important Torah topic? Is that better, worse, more, less than sitting on a Zoom call with five people and talking about a Torah topic?
Yeah, this is a great question, because I think it is the epitome of how different generations might look at the same situation with very different eyes. And this is not judgmental about age, and it's ultimately not about technology in my mind. It's about what's normative and what are your priorities. And people come with very different experiences. I would say that the technology has enabled us to have a larger marketplace of opportunities and ideas and expertise. And so people who have grown up with that larger marketplace allocate their time and attention and energy and ultimately dollars based on different criteria than previous generations might have done. And because of that, quality and convenience and accessibility become greater criteria for making those choices than it being local or in person or having any kind of allegiance to a particular organization. So when we hear people say, oh, millennials don't join things, they're not going to be members, they don't have long-term relationships with organizations, it's not because they don't care that those things exist. It's because with a larger number of choices, they're going to pursue the things that are the greatest fit for their own interests and lives.
And at that time in their life, right, that might be different depending on they've moved or if they have a kid.
So I actually think that what you described is not about technology. I think it's incredibly human. I just think we have the ability to be a little bit pickier and a little bit more nuanced in where we choose to put our time and attention, right? It's not just ABC, NBC, and CBS to choose your news. There's like an infinite number of places to go. Same thing in the Jewish community. And I think one of our biggest problems, honestly, is mediocrity. Because if somebody comes to look for something that's Jewish and it's like, well, there's a gazillion other things out there that are super interesting and really high quality. And I might be drawn to that, you know, food blog more than I'm drawn to some Jewish education blog because of the quality of it. So I think we do have to consider, we're not just competing with other similar Jewish opportunities and experiences. It's about people's time and attention writ large across their lives. And so what we offer has to be of certain quality, specificity, and value so that people feel compelled to put their time and attention to it. I actually think the ability to access high quality things at any time, anywhere from multiple devices, whether you're sitting on a train or you're at home or wherever else, is a huge benefit. And we have to be active players in that marketplace to thrive and to reach people. And every touch point is a stepping stone to something more.
For those that listened to the episode before this one with David from Reboot, we had an inadvertent love fest about his work, you know, because I've participated in other 10Q program for, you know, probably close to 10 years. And I don't think I've ever been asked for money from them or as part of that program. and I don't do anything else with them. I didn't know what else they did, right? But my experience of the high holidays is infinitely expanded, and the meaningfulness of it to me is just incredibly heightened by this program that Reboot does. It's kind of an interesting flip sometimes that we're looking at as far as funding, which I know is super off topic, but it's the top down of funding, right? It's not necessarily that people are looking for things that are free. You know, I'm never going to ask my listeners for money. You know, I'm never going to ask those that are consuming my product for money, but I'm going to go to a maker of Talit and ask them to give me money so that I can do this. I'm going to go to a foundation. I'm going to go to a rich friend of mine, right? I'm going to go to other people who I'm hoping will support me in providing something for people, so that you allow for the accessibility of feeling Jewish, of being Jewishly connected, of being Jewishly engaged, and not feeling gouged or not feeling like there's a two-way expectation, mm-hmm. which I'm sure to some people sounds terrible. Like, you're taking this product and you're not even supporting it. It sounds like public radio too, right? I listen every single morning and I have not given to public radio in many, many years. And when I do have extra income, I will probably give to public radio. But until then, I will continue to consume it for free and hope that there are still people who do have extra income and foundations and people that want to advertise that will support that to come to me. And I don't want to feel bad about that, right? So yeah. I love that you kind of bring up this accessibility thing, is that, you know, in that conversation I had, I was just like, I want everyone to do this, right? I want everyone to participate in what you're providing, because the value to an individual is so much greater than all those kind of seemingly smaller, petty things that people think when they're running a business, right? When they're trying to keep their doors open and trying to meet an annual budget and all of those things, that when we really think about Jewish engagement and why, the why of Jewish engagement, but even just the how and what that might look like and how we might provide meaning.
And there are so many different models. I mean, if you're talking about financial models, we have based so many organizations on membership dues or program fees and donations, which have just really reinforced this transactional model that I think kind of erodes the relational model and the development of community that we were talking about before. Philanthropic support is obviously one huge piece of the puzzle. And I think the Jewish community has come to rely on that quite a bit. It's made a ton of fascinating things possible. But I think there's a lot of shades of gray in between that. And I think that in today's economy, we see lots of really creative innovation happening in that. One of the words I use a lot that I think is not understood as deeply as I would like it to be in the Jewish world is the idea of a platform. And instead of having an organization and programs and then tushes and seats, how might we help create platforms for people to do more and do better and maybe more often and in a deeper way? I think One Table is a great example of this. Mm-hmm. Amplifier is a great example of this. To some degree, Moisha House is even an example of this, although they have, you know, assets that are a little bit bigger in terms of like housing.
There's not a staff person in each house who is creating the program that Moisha House North American is telling them to do, that everyone is doing at the same time, right? It's right. A very
and there's shades
platform
of gray
to do it. Right, right.
Yeah, lots of shades of gray of what platform can look like. But Airbnb is a platform. People with available housing list it. People who want housing go and buy it. Uber and Lyft are platforms, right? The company provides a certain amount of technology and the things that are needed as a foundation to make this marketplace work. And then the drivers use that platform to make money, and the riders use that platform to get where they want to go. And we have very few of these in the Jewish community. It's less control. It's a totally different way to function. But it ultimately, I think, is a much leaner and more sustainable economic model. And more importantly, I think it empowers the people to be active, creative agents in creating the community and experiences that they want to have. And I think that's a profound shift from a couple generations back to people who are young and young adults today, of what kind of role they want to play in creating their own lives. They've grown up in an age where the tools and the permission and the opportunity is there, and they're going to expect that amount of freedom and empowerment. So it's our job to figure out how to support that, not just financially in terms of giving grants to make those things happen, but also in terms of the quality and the facilitation of helping people do what they want.
Wonderful. So we're going to kind of shift a little bit and think about the people that you've worked with in all of the Jewish organizations over your many years of engagement, and kind of a little bit about your advice for current professionals, but also things that you've seen that have made people successful in making this shift. I know you talked about earlier that you like to work at organizations that are ready for risk, that are ready for, you know, already kind of a little bit ahead of that bell curve and want to be pulled along to pull everybody else along. So what do you see in successful leaders, in not successful leaders? What advice do you have for people in the field who are looking at these challenges, you know, square in the face and maybe trying to make those changes or not sure about those changes or not sure where to make those changes, all that good stuff?
I find that emotions play a really big role here. Risk tolerance and fear are huge components of whether I see leaders embracing opportunities to make change or resisting that change. Every person in every organization is going to have a different kind of risk tolerance depending on their situation. There's no right or wrong answer to that. But I have seen a number of people who seem to have their head in the sand or are afraid of ruffling feathers or want to find consensus, or things are designed by committee and thus right. kind of watered down. And I think that gets in the way a lot. And so the people who I see that have vision and see the crack where the light's coming in and want to pursue and lead in that direction need a lot of support and cheerleading, because the voices of resistance can be loud. We also need to balance that with the voices of encouragement and support, whether that be mentoring or having safe spaces to think things out loud. I have found a lot of funders can be really great partners in thinking these things through because they've seen it. And not just the, you know, Jewish philanthropy article when it's a huge success story, but also like, what were all the complicated things that were going on behind the scenes, or learning from that failure and sharing what you've learned? I think it's all really important. I've started doing these things called trend reports, which are like little snapshots of research, not just about what's happening in the Jewish community, but also what's happening kind of wider in certain generations or demographics, as a way of helping leaders see what's fact versus, you know, opinions or ideas. And when you can see, like, these are the data trends, this is where it's going, this is just factual information, now what are we going to do with it? It changes people's tolerance for change. Sometimes they can see that the risk of staying the same is actually greater than the risk of change. Hmm. And when you cross that threshold, all of a sudden everything looks really different. And I think as the millennial generation now is becoming parents and starting to have income and buy houses and give donations to things, that's going to shift a lot. And we're going to see that kind of change pick up pretty quickly.
And I think it's hard sometimes when you're in those older legacy organizations trying to make this shift. And not that it's a threat, but you see the organizations that have been created in the last 10 years and it feels so easy, right, for them, because that's how they were created, right, with this very digital, very communal framework from the start, right? So obviously it's a lot easier to create something brand new than to shift and change something that's been there for a very long time. So I'll go back to kind of a bit of my previous question. What is it that makes somebody successful in being able to make this change?
I think having vision is really important. And I also don't think that vision needs to be fully baked, right? Vision isn't necessarily a plan. It's seeing something way ahead so that you have direction. Sharing that vision and getting people on board with it. So now you've got a team of people rowing in more or less the same direction and who all have different, you know, kind of experiences and skills to help make that vision come to life, and helping people feel like they all have some skin in the game. It's everyone's success, not just your success as an individual leader. And also being really clear that there's risk involved. Like, it may not be simple and straightforward, but that's part of the fun and the challenge. Or quick, right? Yeah. Exactly. And to that point, I would say having a lot of milestones along the way and celebrating those milestones and small successes is really important. So I had a day school I was working with a few years ago that was really trying to create a more social participatory culture in their social media. They had for a while just been like making announcements and using it as a bullhorn. I was trying to teach them, this is a social environment, so you have to be a good socialite. And they were trying and trying and trying and trying. And like nothing was working, and they were asking questions and nobody would respond. One day they were planning a parent-teacher association meeting for the next day, and they posted on Facebook, "Buying snacks for tomorrow morning's meeting. Do you prefer bagels or muffins?" People went bananas. Like, some people wanted this. Some people requested this. "I'm allergic to nuts. Please don't get muffins with nuts. I'm actually gluten-free. Could you have some fruit there?" You know, like, everybody chimed in.
Right.
It was such like a moment of celebrating a small success.
That's awesome.
But there was a lot to be learned from it. Like, on the one hand, you might think it's like stupid and, you know, just a petty example. On the other hand, they learned a lot that you have to start at a place where people feel like they can participate.
Right.
If you're asking a question about Israeli politics on Facebook, nobody's going to dare participate. If you're asking what flavor of muffin do you want, it's very low risk. People are happy to participate. You know, there's a lot of lessons here about being a community builder and a community organizer that really, I think, apply to leading change in today's age, because it's not the same kind of top-down leadership as we once had. It's a different model of leading, and how important the vision and the communication of that vision and the recognition of the humanity of that team is really important. And having everybody feel like they're a really important player in making that vision come to life. There's a couple of books, examples from books that I love that I'll just share in case your listeners are ever like looking for some further reading. First, there's a book by William Bridges called Managing Transition. And it talks about the difference between psychological and situational transition. So psychological transition is, we're getting a new database system and I have to learn how to make use of this new tool. And situational is, on Monday morning, the old system is turning off and the new one is turning on. It's much more of like a light switch. Mm-hmm. Or we're closing the factory is the situational announcement. But what people are going to do for the next 6 months as we wind down the operations of that factory is psychological. And the way that you lead through those two different things looks really different. And we have to be very aware, I think, especially in the nonprofit community and especially in the Jewish community, when the people we're working with are also part of our, you know, tribe outside of the office. And there's so many values in it. We have to be particularly attentive to that psychological based leadership. The other book is an example from Switch, where there's a operations person who notices that the company, it's a construction company, and notices they buy a lot of things that they need from different suppliers all over the country. And there's a lot of inefficiencies. And he makes up this huge spreadsheet. And he comes and he delivers it to the, you know, big meeting of all of the managers. And like, nobody pays attention. He's like, we're wasting literally millions of dollars and nobody's paying attention. So the next meeting, he comes and puts a pile of gloves on the table, work gloves, with the huge price tag with the number written in Sharpie. And as people walk in, they're like, what is this? This is the same pair of gloves as $22 here and $41 over there. Like, why are they different? And he gets their attention,
right?
Because he has communicated something to them in a very different way. And I think, as much as I love that the Jewish community has focused on business leadership and nonprofit management and more of these businessy terms, which I think is a huge gain, we risk focusing only on the nuts and bolts and the spreadsheets and the policy decisions and forgetting that we're leading teams of people who are doing this because it's part of their identity and their spiritual journey and a sense of belonging to something larger than themselves. And I think we can learn some leadership lessons from that.
I will add those to my book recommendation list. Very interesting way of thinking about change that I really haven't heard as far as the mechanical and the psychological and realizing we're dealing with people. And it's easy to say, oh, well, we're going to go from doing this to doing this. And it makes a lot of sense, and not think so much about the psychological implications of what that change might mean. That's awesome. Wonderful. So bringing it again back to you a little bit, as I introduced you, it was very obvious. You serve in many different ways in lay leadership capacity in a variety of different organizations. So clearly this is a value to you to give your time and your expertise. And I'd love for you to just kind of touch upon why. Obviously, you don't have to be, you know, that involved in a leadership-free capacity. I'm sure you have plenty of, you know, paid work on your plate to be doing. So I'd love for you to just talk about why. Why is this an important thing in your life to be as involved as you are?
I think it's really important that we have communities that have thriving civic and social organizations. And I'm a real believer in that it takes a village to do anything, whether that comes to like carpooling my children around or having organizations that add value. So it's just generally a value of mine. I'm pretty picky about where I give that time, however. Some of it is to organizations where the mission is something that's very intriguing to me or I'm particularly passionate about. Some of them are organizations that have people, often those who are on the board, but sometimes those who are staff too, who I feel like I have a lot to learn from. And sometimes it's organizations that are in a moment or situation in their evolution that has a particular business challenge. And they need somebody to help them think it through and do some business strategy and planning around it and navigating tough things or exciting things. And I also feel like throwing myself into those situations is a great way to continue to learn. Mm-hmm. So I feel like between building my own nonprofit and being on the boards of many of these others, I've kind of gone to business school without right. ever having to go to class.
Right.
It's a great joy of mine. I like to feel that every hour I invest is both very useful to the organization and meaningful to me in some way. So as I've done more and more volunteer work, I have come to know myself better, what I feel is a good use of my time and where I can be most helpful to organizations. So there's many where they ask me to be on the board and I say, you know what? That's not the best use of my time. I know you're dealing with this one particular thing. I'm happy to give you 15 or 20 hours of my time over right. the next 3 months. Give me like a hardcore specific project. Let's go full throttle and then I'm out. And those are great. Like I can only do one of those a year really right. at that level, but it's a place where I feel like I can make an important difference. And I always learn something, which is the most important part.
So given that, how do you keep everything balanced and get everything done between your family and work and your volunteer activities? Any techniques that you use, any things you implement, things you keep on the forefront of your mind while you're running around like crazy in a good way?
That's a great question. I hope you ask every single one of
I
your
do, yes.
people. And then we just need to like consolidate all of the brilliant answers. Honestly, it's the hardest part. I really value flexibility over all else. So one of the reasons why I think basically being in a consulting role is a great fit for me is that I have a lot of control over my schedule and I can manage my family and my children's needs at the same time as having a pretty demanding and exciting career at the same time. It's taken a while for me to get really clear on how to balance my time and how much total I can take on. And that's like hours, but it's also brain power. And right. it's also like, how much am I thinking about it as I'm falling asleep at night? And I would say finding the support systems that are the places I'm willing to delegate and that can save me a lot of time and brain space. So as I've gotten busier and a little more mature, I have become a better delegator. And so surrounding myself both professionally, but also personally with people that I really trust and can assign things to is to me the difference that makes me sane.
I struggle a little bit with that because I like to be the boss that's also in the trenches. Mm-hmm. So instead of it being like, oh, here you do this, being like, well, let's do this together. Or like, could you help me with this? Or I'll take on this little piece of it and you do the rest of it. Cause I want people that I work with to feel like I'm in it with them. But then I end up doing the work that you know other people could be doing. And not that I don't necessarily envy people that can just kind of push stuff off to other people. Cause at some points that makes me, you know, a little bit annoyed. Cause I'm like, come on, man, like, or woman, but you know, be in it with everybody. Definitely a hard thing to learn how to do in an effective way of trusting other people around you to do the work that needs to get done.
For sure. Well, I've been fortunate to have great mentors and I've done some studying about being a mentor, which has helped me finesse that role where it's not just like delegating and letting go, but it's a different kind of teamwork or partnership when I'm in a mentoring role, but I'm hopefully really trusting that person to do it. But I still have a voice a little bit and it's been really fun to mentor those people. And now I'm old enough to have seen some of those people grow up. Miriam Brousseau, who we've both worked with, is a great example of that. I mean, I met her when she was basically just out of school and over years have seen her grow. She just does incredible work. But the other piece of this is a term I like to call tsimtsuming, right? So the Jewish idea of tsimtsum is contraction, right? God had to contract in order to create the world and free will and all of this. And I think as leaders, we need to practice tsimtsuming. Oftentimes, if you're in a position of leadership, it means you're really good at something and you probably have high standards. And so it's really hard to let go right. of things, but not only for your own sanity, but really to allow the next generation of leaders to have the opportunities to take things and run with it and have a voice and grow in their responsibility, we got to pull back a little bit and make some space. And I think that's true in any career or discipline or as a parent or, you know, in all these different ways in our lives, we have to learn how to contract ourselves a little bit to make space for others. And it's something that I'm constantly working on. And I would say in my 40s, I have just started to get good at it.
Yeah, that is fantastic advice. Wonderful. So we've covered a lot about your work and your experience and your view on how things are kind of changing and moving. Anything else that you want to touch upon that you feel like we haven't talked about already?
The one thing I guess I will mention is I see a lot of organizations with really smart, creative, mid-level staff who I just want to point out are a great asset to larger or older organizations looking to make change. And that there are people worth listening to and empowering. I see some organizations that are creating almost like little innovation engines within their larger organization to play with ideas or try things out or throw it up against the wall and see if it sticks or pilot things and prototype it. So it's not a huge investment of resources, but it's using internal assets that you might already have to start to propel some of the innovation and change that I think a lot of organizations are wanting. It's kind of like a muscle. You have to exercise it. And the more that you do, the quicker you'll find that, oh my gosh, we actually do have this capacity to innovate or change or try new things or evolve our culture or those things. And sometimes it's actually easiest to start with your staff who are maybe, you know, 10 or 20 years younger than your senior leadership and to listen. There's a lot to be learned from those people. And they are often the ones that have really fast growing career trajectories. I think many of the people that you have had on this podcast are in fact those people who 10 or 20 years ago were those, you know, younger early stage professionals who had vision and some ideas. And some of them were able to exercise those muscles within the context of their employers and their organizations to make change from the inside. And others didn't see that they had the chance to exercise that inside of an older, bigger organization. And so they went out and innovated on their own and started something new. But I think there are a lot of great examples of those kind of people today who are really the change makers in the Jewish community. And I just want to flag both for those people, like keep on innovating, like find the places where you can try things out, even in small ways, and learn from it and teach people. And for some more senior level management people who feel like they have those folks embedded in their organizations, like go take those folks out to coffee and just listen. Like you'll learn a ton. And they will also appreciate your mentorship. It becomes a very mutually beneficial relationship.
Yeah, I've touched upon a little bit about that in some of my earlier guests, just the idea that the more you develop your people, even if they leave, but better that they leave, that's the reputation of your organization in our community, not to overuse the word. But the more you have, you know, happy, successful employees that move up in their responsibilities and learn, and as you mentioned, innovate, the better it reflects on you. Like, oh, I came from blah, blah, blah organization. They're like, oh yeah, this other person came from there and they're really awesome, right? So I think it's getting out of that very icky, selfish, self-contained, egotistical, whether it's egotistical for your organization or for yourself, right? You hear a lot from older people thinking millennials are crazy or it's all about millennials and what about everybody else? And kind of this thinking of really putting that aside and seeing the value in all of your staff, regardless of kind of where they are in their experience. But it also made me think about Google, and they do like a 10% innovation time where they can do literally whatever they want, you know, that is within the scope of the organization. And they, you know, some of their best ideas have come out of millennials sitting in a room saying, what if, you know? What if this? What if that? What if this? And I'm sure there are hundreds of post-it note ideas on the floor, but out of those 100, you know, have come some really interesting things that have worked. So as far as building that in as your organizational culture, it's not easy, but it's definitely something that would be able to pay off.
I totally agree. I heard an interesting interview the other day with some of the lead folks at Lyft. It was on NPR, and I am a donor. And
thank you.
The interviewer said, you know, A few years ago, I was interviewing the CEO of Netflix, and I asked all these questions. It was a great interview, but I was asking about the red envelope. And in the CEO's mind, he'd already moved on to streaming, and he knew that 6 months later, this big announcement was going to happen, and it was all going to be different. So he said to the folks at Lyft, I know the business model that you're doing now, but what do I not know that's your vision for the future? And I thought the answer was great. I will summarize it to the best of my memory. But he said, people see us as kind of a replacement for taxis, kind of transportation service. But our real vision is actually about how we develop cities, and that cities in the US are developed primarily around single passenger car transportation. And the way that we plan our cities and how much real estate the roads take up and the parking and, you know, all this other stuff is based around cars. And what if we designed our cities around people and around communities, not around cars? What would change? So we're trying to solve the transportation problem so that our cities don't have to be designed around cars. And I thought it was such a brilliant answer. And I often think about kind of analogous things that in the Jewish community, we have big ideas and vision and values and peoplehood and history and like so many big meaningful things. And sometimes I feel like we get bogged down in like, you know, institutional stuff. And we lose the joy and the big picture vision of why we're all doing this in the first place. I like to just remind people of the very big picture, even as we're working in the particulars, and that there's a lot of different paths to get there.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your insight and experience with us, Lisa. I really appreciate it.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me, Michelle.
In today's age, the use of technology is such a complicated issue. From people being on their phones during meetings, to attempting to hold video calls, to webinar services cutting out on us, to 24/7 emails, to how we send communications via emails, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Pinterest, and on and on. It's enough to make anyone's head spin, no matter what generation you are from. I do not envy our communications and marketing professionals out there as they attempt to navigate this very complicated world. What I heard from Lisa was a bit beyond the importance of properly using technology to our advantage. It was more about how intentional we are about how and why we are bringing people together in meaningful community. When we face challenges of declining contributions, membership numbers, attendance, or mission relevance, sometimes the answer lies in how our operating model fits the world around us. How are we encouraging and supporting bonds and ties between the people in our community? And how do we bring new people into that space to experience those same benefits of helping work toward your shared vision and mission? When that is your focus, as I've talked about before on this program, the money will follow. If a family is a member of your synagogue paying maybe $180 a year, after they've been involved for 1 or 2 years, they might give you $400 or $500 at the High Holiday campaign or drop $1,000 at your annual fundraiser. When they feel the value of the connections they're getting and have the means to give, they'll give. Ensuring your institution is up to date with the look and feel of the way you communicate that message is so important as one of the first entry points people have to your work. You better make sure that that's a good first impression. This program has been funded in part by the Jim Joseph Foundation. Our editor is Nick Bowden of Bowden Sound, and our fiscal sponsor is Jewish Creativity International. You can find previous episodes, guest bios, podcast articles, how to start your own podcast, and more on our website. It's whoyouknowthepodcast.com. This is your host, Michelle W. Malkin. Thank you for listening, and have a wonderful week.